As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
The fact that they can make a one-time change that looks just like their ag lime practice today, and that carbon can be removed over just a few years, and it's permanent and it's irreversible. I was like, those are the types of technologies that are going to scale and blow this out of the water, because it's just so much easier for farmers to do and adopt. And so, yeah, I fell in love with rock weathering. I found my way back to rocks.
There's so many quotes that I've never heard before in my life, including, I fell in love with rock weathering. Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in technology. I'm your host, Danny Fortson, and this week we are talking about rocks. Don't turn off the pod. Seriously, this is interesting. So did you know that certain types of rocks are extremely good at pulling CO2 out of the air naturally? They are pollution sponges. Well, what if we just found those, ground them all up, turned them into effectively sand or dust, which in the process dramatically increases their surface area and thus their ability to clean up the air, clean up the planet? Well, that is exactly what Ion is doing, which is a Detroit-based startup. And on the program, we have their chief executive, Anna Pavlovich Hans. Hope I'm saying all that right, to talk about the company Enhanced Rock Weathering, which is what they call it. They really need to come up with some better branding. The industry, not Ion. And how Anna ended up getting into this, let's say, not super obvious industry. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy this one, not least because Ion is an example of one of the many companies in climate tech that really fall clearly outside the obvious energy and transport buckets, but are taking novel approaches to this climate emergency and thus, you know, the massive climate opportunity, and how other companies like Stripe, you know, the big payments giant, are helping kind of seed a whole new generation of startups like these through some pretty novel financing deals. Lots of kind of interesting moving parts here. Anyway, lots of fun stuff, including poisonous centipedes and snakes slithering through living rooms. It's true. Anyway, stick around for that. You guys are going to enjoy this, so I will now hand you over to my conversation with Anna of Ion. Enjoy. I think we just need to start at the obvious question. What is enhanced rock weathering? I feel like there's got to be a better name for what this is.
Yes, it's a little bit of a mouthful. We call it ERW in short. So the way I like to describe it is that special rocks have this amazing ability to remove carbon from the atmosphere naturally over time. And so what enhanced rock weathering does is allow us to accelerate that process. We can do things like adjust the surface area of the rock and adjust where the rock is applied so that we're able to just speed up this very natural process from thousands of years or hundreds of years to, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And so this is super important because we're able to speed up the amount of carbon that we can remove and combat climate change and temperate warming in a really incredible way.
The rocks we're talking about, they're presumably naturally occurring. What are they? Where are they? How does the process work naturally? And then we can talk about the enhanced part and where you guys come in.
Yeah. So there are many different types of rocks that do this. They're all a little bit different, some known as silicate minerals, many of which have magnesium content. The one that ION uses is called olivine. You might know of it because there's a green sands beach in Hawaii, for example, many people have been to. I used to live on the Big Island, and so I've been there many times. It's an amazing spot. So it's a green rock, naturally occurring. It's special because it's very, very fast at removing carbon. And so naturally, as these rocks exist on our planet, they're reacting with the atmosphere, the soil, the elements, and they're essentially forming bicarbonate bonds that store permanently carbon from the atmosphere in sediment. And those end up going into sediment in the bottom of the ocean over thousands of years. So speeding up that process by adjusting the surface area of the rocks, the chemical nature of the process stays exactly the same. And so does the chemical composition of the rocks. All we change is its speed and ability to do that.
When you say adjusting the surface area of the rock, does that just mean pulverizing it?
Yes, that's right. So some of the rocks are mined today or quarried for other purposes. Some are different types of waste products or slag. And so you can adjust, you can dry them. If they're wet, you can mill them down to a finer content that's like a sand. And then you can apply them in a variety of uses. You asked more about where they are. One of our rock sources today is in Norway on a fjord. But there are many, many other sources, both in the U.S. and globally. They typically occur in places that were volcanic in the past.
Got you. So naturally, these places that are naturally occurring, like that beach you talk about, this is just like this rock is just sitting there and kind of in an ambient way pulling carbon out of the air as a natural state of being. That's just what it does.
Yes. And one of the things that drew me to this technology and I think what the industry is so excited about is that it's kind of a hybrid between a natural carbon removal solution and an engineered one, like direct air capture, some of the other ones you've probably talked to folks about. It's in the middle because we're really not changing the natural aspects of rock doing this, but we are able to use technology to speed it up. And so the technology risk on it is really low, which I love.
What is the technology? So obviously you pulverize it, so you have a lot more. If, you know, just thinking about a rock the size of my hand, if I turn that into dust, then there's a lot more kind of surface area for it to react with the air around it. I understand that.
Yep.
Is that the technology, basically?
One part is you can think of it as like a recipe. So if we want to make that sand perfect for applying into agricultural lands, which is a big part of what we do at ION today and what my background is in doing, there's like a recipe to think about the perfect surface area and composition to be used in an agricultural application. If, for example, you wanted to do this in forestry, and you wanted to apply these rocks into a fine grain in a working forest land, you might be able to use a slightly different recipe. And so one part is sort of that recipe and finding the right match. When do you apply it? How do you apply it? How long is carbon removed? But the bigger part of the technology that's really important is quantifying how this happens. And so the origins of ION and a lot of the science and academia in the enhanced rock weathering community is around the measurement and quantification of how carbon is removed over time. And that is really the breakthrough that has made this technology more scalable in the last years. Previously, that was sort of like only able to be done in a very small R&D kind of lab environment. And now there are more technologies that are allowing us to do this at a greater scale with accuracy at a price point that is able to actually like work in a real world scenario.
So I'm going to make an analogy here that is probably not going to work very well, but I think it kind of gets to my question, which is like, it kind of, what you're saying reminds me of newspapers. Insofar as when I started, you wrote an article, and if you heard from like readers, like, ooh, I like that, or it, whatever, it generated a lot of letters. Like that was the way you knew that it had kind of touched a nerve or people liked it or people found it interesting, but there was no kind of measurement. Now we have a whole system of like every article, you can see how many people logged into it, how long they read it, what the ages were, where they were logging in from. You have all of this whole kind of universe of measurement tools to get much more granular and to actually understand what is working and what is not. So when you're talking about the ability to measure, if we know that, have always known that, like, silicate, for example, pulls carbon out of the air, what's changed? In other words, how is it the, now we know exactly how much it's pulling out, and if so, how do we know that? And then the follow-on, of course, is why is that important?
I think it's a great analogy. So the technology, it uses trace elements of material that are found naturally in these rocks to measure how much carbon is removed over time, kind of like a tracking or like a fingerprint tool. The big thing I think that's changed is that measuring such tiny trace elements is super difficult to do, especially at scale, and it's expensive. And so while, as you say, this process geologically was very well understood in the past, it wasn't easy to quantify this in a way that you could really prove that carbon was removed. And so there's been like an immense amount of work in the last years on what are the different ways you can look at these trace elements to track carbon over time. Interestingly, a lot of the trace element work in the past, and one of our founders was working on this for a national lab, was for looking at the impacts of nuclear contaminants in soils and using trace elements to track that over time. And so they got this idea, you know, could you use this technology to apply to carbon removal? And then we can talk more about why carbon removal is important, because it sounds like that's where you wanted to go next.
Well, so on that trace elements, is it, does the quantity of those elements change because they're, as carbon is kind of bound up in them, that they change their nature, and that's the measure? That's where we can say, well, this was here, we started at X, now we're X plus 10 in terms of carbon removal or whatever.
Yes. It's like think about, you can know exactly how much rock was applied by detecting changes in those trace elements. And then because the process of weathering naturally is so well described, you can connect those trace elements to the amount of bicarbonate bonds that were created and stored. And so that's right. Then you can quantify that. And then you can look at that over different scales, over different time horizons, like in your newspaper analogy, in a way that gives you lots of metadata to kind of look and examine the problem over time.
And that quantification piece, if we all know it works, is the quantification piece important? Because, you know, we just had recently on the podcast Diego Saez-Gill at Pachama, and his whole thing is around creating tools to make it, to basically catalyze carbon reduction projects. So if you're Tesco or Shell or whomever, and you're like, we've got to get to know our net zero pledge, we need to start funding these projects, we need a way to actually prove that what we're doing is legit and not greenwashing or whatever. Is that why this is important, in that it makes it measurable, therefore fundable?
Absolutely. Exactly the same use cases, exactly the same partners. In some cases, companies who are trying to both figure out how to reduce emissions within their own supply chains. And so certainly those that touch agriculture, and we can talk more about agriculture in a moment, but thinking about investing in that, as you say, they have to be able to prove and have systems and methodologies that prove that carbon was removed, to make it fundable, to make these massive projects financeable, just like solar or other types of renewables in the future.
If I'm a farmer, why would I spread a bunch of silicate on my field?
So this is where it gets really fun.
I thought we were already there, but I can't wait now.
Okay, so my background, and I'll tell you more about that, but my background, I was thinking about modeling different types of agricultural systems. That got me into thinking about soil organic carbon. Like Pachama, in forestry, there's kind of a biomass and a soil organic carbon component. I was thinking about how you can work with farmers to change their management practices to more sustainable practices over time. And as you say, when you ask, you know, why would farmers make these changes? What's in it for them? In the case of soil carbon, they're making changes that often make their land more resilient to extreme weather, to changes and year-over-year changes in their crop based on, like, you know, if there's a huge drought, if there's a flood. Those changes take a long time to see. They're very important to farmers, and farmers believe that those changes can work, but they are risky to implement in the near term, and they take a lot of, like, financing and support to help farmers make those changes. And so what I think is really amazing about enhanced rock weathering in the farmer context is that I believe that the future of scaling these technologies with farmers is that you have to have a tool that slots very easily into their existing system. And so today, farmers are used to applying something called ag lime. It is a ground up limestone, often quarried, that they apply it because it helps with their pH mitigation. And so every couple of years, you know, if their soils are getting a little bit too acidic, they top up with an application of ag lime. We've been applying ag lime in agriculture for, I don't know, 60, 70 years or more. It's super well understood. It's not exciting to farmers. They have to do it, but it's a part of it. And so what I think is really interesting about people, like you mentioned, like, you know, the Tescos, the food companies of the world, the people who are funding this, this actually allows farmers to change almost nothing about what they're doing today, apply a product that looks almost identical to what they apply in ag lime in the same amounts, and to get, like, a rebate or an incentive to do so from making these carbon removal changes that impact our climate in a positive way. And to me, reducing that farmer friction is the only way that you're able to do this at this massive scale.
And can you talk about the potential here? Because I was doing some reading before we got on, and it sounds like, so, like, stepping back and just listening, anybody listening to this conversation be like, yeah, that sounds cool. Yeah. I mean, great. Yet another thing that we can do that's not really going to move the needle, but it sounds like this actually could move the needle, especially if you scale this up.
That's right. So if you think about, you know, there's give or take 900 million acres of arable land in the U.S. and in cropping systems. The thing that's beautiful about enhanced rock weathering is that there are other technologies where you have to build massive plants or structures that actually, like, do the removal. The cool thing is that when we look at those 900 million acres, there's this vast agricultural value chain that already exists to serve those communities, that's moving materials to them and is taking commodities and crops and moving them, like, out into the places where they go to be consumed. We don't have to rebuild all that infrastructure to take advantage of it. It all exists and serves these farmer bases today. And so if you think about applying these types of practices on millions of acres, you know, by 2030, we have goals to be removing 10 million tons of carbon per year. And this is, like, a massive dent in our goal to create carbon removal at scale over the next 10 years. And we don't have to do massive plant building, solar farms, et cetera, to be able to make those changes. And that's one of the reasons I love it so much.
What is 10 million? How does that compare to, I don't know, America's annual carbon footprint or the agricultural industry's carbon footprint? Like, you know, what's the scale there?
So there was a IPCC report, which is the, you know, the UN's panel on climate change, which was measuring our need for getting to removals in the gigatons of carbon per year by 2030. And there's very little way we're going to get anywhere near that. Many of the other carbon removal pathways that exist, you know, the biggest limiters are that these technologies are expensive and they take time to come online. It looks as if rock weathering alone could do, like, 2 gigatons of that 10 gigaton goal. And that's, like, so incredible from a technology that really is existing already today in nature that we're just, like, speeding up.
And is that globally, that 2 gigatons?
That's right.
Right. What's the blocker here? Why wouldn't this be? And this is kind of a question I always ask when you hear, because, you know, we've had lots of people in the climate tech world on this pod over the last couple of years, especially. And there's lots of like amazing solutions. And as you say, oftentimes they're just too expensive still or whatever. But the question always comes up is just like, well, if this is so great, then why aren't we just like, why isn't everybody doing it? Why isn't like the government or somebody being like, this is an amazing ready-made solution. Let's go hell for leather for it and start it.
Luckily, it's starting. The keys that I would note, like the other pathways, it is expensive to do today. One of the things that's important about the technology that you asked about with respect to how do we measure it, how do we quantify it, if you think about what it would take to do this type of measurement on a gigaton scale, you would want the prices of monitoring and quantifying this, you know, on a per ton or per acre basis to be probably under $20 an acre or ton, something like this, because you just can't scale without it. Today, it is expensive because we believe that in order to prove, you know, we know that this process works scientifically, but in order to prove that it works operationally at scale in different geographies, in different climates, we need to produce as an industry much more data to build trust in the academic community, in the science community, in the consumer community. And so I believe that the limiters today are related to that price point and how do we scale to bring the cost curve, you know, work down the cost curve while we're also building trust. And so the hard part is if you move into like a software modeling approach. So if you think about what I did in my past career where we were looking at software models that can model this, that is the future of where the rock weathering industry will go. What is needed to be able to deliver such awesome calibrated models that work in use cases all over the world? A lot of data to train them. And so think of it today as we're investing in an expensive technology, but we're generating data that is going to power the models and like lower direct sampling approaches in the future so that this is like way cheaper. But yeah, the biggest limiter is how do people fund and pay for this? The government, as your question, the government is investing a lot. There have been a bunch of big opportunities coming out lately, both out of USDA as well as Department of Energy, to look at building these technologies and growing projects in these technologies. I believe in the future, the government is going to be an amazing enabler to help us scaling these technologies globally.
The train is now approaching. At platform, passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
And it seems to me, and it's in this, it sounds a little dumb, but I don't think it is because we're humans. But like, it feels like part of the challenge for you is that this isn't a giant offshore wind farm or a huge solar array or like a direct air capture plant, which is all these pipes and fans and stuff. It's just dust or sand or whatever. And you just throw it on a field and you're like, trust me, this is doing as much or more than all these big fancy machines or these things that we can viscerally see, touch, and feel. At the same time, you have an industry that has, you know, in fits and starts has been like a bunch of dodgy projects that were got funded. And so a lot of people have been burned. A lot of companies are like, have been left with egg on their face. We're like, yeah, we're refunding this reforestation project in X or Y or whatever. And it ends up being complete nonsense. So does that feel real to you as just like an obstacle to overcome for the company to really kind of get real momentum?
Absolutely. The human element, it's strange, and soil organic carbon, which makes our soils and farms so much stronger, so much more resilient, able to perform better in a variety of ways. It's so crazy to talk about investing in, because like you can't see it. It's difficult to measure. It's intangible. And I think you're spot on. I personally believe that we also need to do an excellent job of educating people overall that this exists. Most people, when I tell them what I do, they say, is that real?
Yeah.
People do that. That's a thing. And so I think, you know, bringing people around, that's exactly right, to the fact that it doesn't have to be a huge physical factory in order to make the changes. Evermore tells me that we have to do an excellent job of creating data that proves this and proves the scalability of it over time.
How did you get involved in this? Like how did you end up here?
It's a crazy story. So I grew up in West Virginia in, you know, coal country, a place deeply affected by mining.
Yeah.
I moved when I was 10, funnily enough, to Western Australia, also a place
very heavy mining. Yeah, yeah.
By mining.
Sorry, how did you end up in Western Australia from West Virginia?
Yeah, it's crazy to me because like it wasn't because of mining, although that's like one of the only corollaries. My mom married my stepdad, who's Australian, and grew up there. And so we moved there.
And where in Western Australia? Perth?
I lived in a town called Kalgoorlie, which is one of the biggest open pit gold mining towns in the Southern Hemisphere.
I knew I recognized. I used to cover mining, so I remember I remember that name. Yeah.
It's a wild place. Western Australia is so beautiful, so incredible, but also deeply affected by mining. It's the heart of the GDP as coal is in West Virginia, but it has this wealth of, you know, and frankly, like a weird connection to rock weathering, because it could be one of the places where we do rock weathering. And so I find it amazing that I came back to rocks. But so what happened next? I was always a big like science and engineering kind of kid. I ended up studying engineering. I did electrical engineering and systems engineering.
In Australia or here back here?
In West Virginia.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I came back to the States, and I did a couple startups in like DC in the security defense space.
As you do right before you go into rock weathering.
It's very weird. I ended up thinking about our post 9/11 data intelligence world was such a crazy place to be working on large scale data systems. And I got to thinking about like, what is the next frontier that looks like this? And I became obsessed with a couple topics. One was climate and sustainability, although this was in 2015 when climate, especially in the like VC space, was just not that hot yet.
Dead, yeah.
Yeah. And ag tech was this new frontier that was early and growing.
But what is the dotted line from security, like DC security establishment, to ag tech and climate tech?
Only that I believed that the shape of the problems was similar.
I see.
That if you are able to generate the amounts of data that we're talking about to impact the systems, like on a global scale, like I was thinking about like, what are the other industries that are going to need to have these types of solutions that like I was working on, and agriculture was one of them that like I couldn't stop thinking about. So I ended up growing an ag tech startup. I loved that. I loved agriculture.
What was the startup, or what were you doing?
It was called SIBO. It was in Boston, and it was modeling through different types of software systems and mechanistic models, things like what would the outcomes be of producing a crop? So for example, if you're Kraft Heinz and you're thinking about, you know, if our global temperature increases by 1 degree C, where am I going to produce my tomato supply chain? Because it's not going to look the way it does today. How would I model that? What data and what models would I use to answer those types of questions? So we were working with food companies, working with ag and R&D companies to answer questions like that using our software.
Where are tomatoes going to be grown?
If you and I could answer that question perfectly, we wouldn't be sitting here.
We'd both be rich.
But it is a crazy topic when we think about how do we look at land use overall, right? And so this is actually what became fascinating to me. So when you zoom out from that problem, you start to say, how could I model things like what is the perfect use of this piece of land? Is it agriculture? Is it forestry? Yeah. Do you make it a wind farm? Do you do rock weathering on it? And so I started thinking about that. And I got obsessed with, you mentioned Pachama. In the early days, Pachama was like one of the companies that I was looking at who was doing this, thinking about carbon credits as a mechanism to help landowners change. And so I was thinking about, you know, if you could model those systems perfectly, and you could say, I believe that, you know, over the next 25 years, these are the best uses of this land. How would you incentivize the people who own or manage that land to do something different? And so carbon credits and different types of project financing became really interesting to me. And I ended up working on a, like I mentioned to you, a soil organic carbon company, which was called Agoro. And our work was in making financial engineering systems and data and agronomy systems that could help farmers and ranchers change their practices long term to be more sustainable. And we grew to several million acres in the US, also in Brazil. I had a like beautiful few years building my team of agronomists and technologists and futurists and otherwise there. And my main takeaway from that is even when you can take an enormous amount of the risk financially off of farmers and ranchers to be able to do this, it's still incredibly difficult to make these changes. And it takes a really long time to see the impact. And so when I learned about rock weathering and I started to meet people in the rock weathering space, the fact that they can make a one-time change that looks just like their ag lime practice today, and that carbon can be removed over just a few years and it's permanent and it's irreversible, I was like, those are the types of technologies that are going to scale and blow this out of the water because it's just so much easier for farmers to do and adopt. And so, yeah, I fell in love with rock weathering. I found my way back to rocks.
There's so many quotes that I've never heard before in my life, including... I fell in love with rock weathering. A first for Danny in the Valley. So congratulations.
Never boring.
So how did you end up at ION?
When I was growing the ag tech company that I mentioned to you in Boston, there were a lot of early stage ag tech companies growing around that same time. And it's a pretty like small, you know, close-knit industry. So Adam, the founder of ION, was growing an ag tech company. I knew of him. I ended up meeting one of the team members in my work at Agoro in the soil carbon side. And she told me that I had to know more about their technology. And I knew a little bit already. And so I started meeting more of the team members. I started learning more. I started diving into the unit economics, the scalability, the science, and I had to join.
And when was that?
It was in September of last year, 23.
And I'm interested also in the role of Stripe and what they're doing.
Yes.
Because I think, as we've kind of touched on already, you know, it's really about you're having this whole new generation of technologies. Some of them are ready for prime time. A lot are not. A lot, you know, I lived in London before and I covered that first wave of green tech where, you know, like rooftop solar was getting so heavily subsidized right as China started ramping up manufacturing, and you had this like window where all of a sudden these people were getting like super cheap solar and really heavily subsidized, and it was like this amazing investment. And then all of a sudden they ripped it all away, and it was still people putting it up because like, oh, actually this makes sense now. But it was just like a really interesting time to watch the markets and government assistance kind of come together to kind of create these industries, whether it's offshore wind, solar, biomass, etc. But it feels like for things like rock weathering are that kind of that next generation of technologies, and the financing mechanisms seem like they're the secret sauce. And Stripe is really interesting. So for those who don't know Stripe, this massive payments processes company out here, I think it might be the biggest private company in America at the moment. It's worth like $50, $60 billion. And they launched a carbon reduction thing. So I don't know if you could talk about what you are doing with them and why it's a big deal.
Yes. Stripe's climate programs, it's amazing to see what, you know, a few futuristic leaders thinking about these problems were able to do in a few short years. Can't say enough good things about the work that they've done. It's a hard problem. As you said, it's going to require many more players and governments to come together to solve. So Stripe started this climate team, and their goal was to invest more through kind of like investments in carbon removal, not equity, in these technologies to increase the top of funnel of technologies that could make it to those gigaton scales that we talked about previously. Now they've also evolved to be one of the leaders that created a coalition called Frontier, which is a group of lots of big companies, including Stripe, that are making similar investments as a group, which is really cool. And they've been also immensely important in growing the ability for these technologies to scale and test and do the things that they need to do. With Stripe, the way they do it is they do an initial purchase.
Purchase of what?
A purchase of the carbon that you can remove as a company. And so for any company that's looking at removing carbon, they say, okay, well, we're going to buy a small amount from you at a very high price point. So, you know, a price point that like the technology is not going to scale to millions of tons with, right? But they believe that by investing, they're going to be able to help the companies work down the cost curve and do the things that they need to do to grow.
So it's basically giving an advance on the removed carbon.
Yep. And we think of them as sort of like the catalytic buyers. They're still buying carbon, but they're doing so in a way that is allowing companies to buy down the cost curve more quickly. And so we did a first deployment of Rock with them in the Mississippi Delta region. And so last year, at the end of last year, 2023, we were the first rock weathering company to make a delivery to Stripe of the carbon that we had promised we would deliver.
When you say the delivery of carbon, what does that actually mean?
So everything you and I talked about with respect to the quantification of that carbon removal, essentially you're taking soil samples before the practice happens and before you apply the rock, and then you're taking samples after over time to use those quantification techniques to prove that the carbon was removed. And so for Stripe, this means that with these early stage technologies, they hire kind of a team of both internal and external experts that can look at the science and prove that the science is strong. And that's one of the ways that they help the industry grow. And so we worked with them on this science to deliver the first tons from our Mississippi project, which is a huge milestone, not just for ION, but for the rock weathering industry, with the goal that we will sell more and work on growing more carbon removal partnerships with big ag, food, tech companies like the ones you mentioned. And so that's been one of the biggest proof points, I think, for us as an industry in making that delivery with Stripe.
Is there enough olivine or silicates or whatever in the world to scale this?
There are. One of the most challenging questions to it is, how do you do it in a way that, when we remember when we talked about those recipes of how do you match the type of rock, the location of rock to the deployment, we have to do that in ways that both makes the least amount of emissions to perform the carbon removal and also minimizes the cost.
Yeah.
Right. Because like there's lots of stuff we could do that like the cost would just be so prohibitive that we couldn't scale. There's hundreds of millions of tons of these types of rocks all over the world. And there's many different types and they're all a little bit different. And so I think what a future looks like is, how are we as an industry learning how to utilize those rocks for their best purpose to build more technologies that measure, you know, in the future, I suspect there will be measurement techniques that work best on specific types of minerals. And we'll be able to match those to like the perfect application in land use, in agriculture, in forestry.
Right. How much money have you guys raised?
We raised $12 million Series A last January 23. And we will be raising a Series B, I suspect, later at the end of 2024.
Got you. And you're based in Detroit.
I'm based in Detroit. Originally, the founders of the company met at Princeton, and one was working on this at Lawrence Livermore. And so he is in Berkeley, and the other founder is still in Princeton. And then the rest of the team is sort of spread across hubs where there are very smart agriculture and climate people, and then some people spread in the regions where we're working in agriculture.
So you're a work from anywhere company.
That's right.
How's that been?
I love it. I grew Agoro in the middle of COVID. I hired 40 people before I met any of them in person.
Wow.
Which, like, to my parents and people that I, you know was like unbelievable. But I'm also a people person, and so I don't take that for granted. But for me, when you look at these technologies, especially that are using land that is distributed across enormous amounts of the planet, you will have centers of mass, but you're never going to have places where all of those people are just like meeting up in an office every day. And so it requires more intense management. Like, I spend an enormous amount of energy getting all of us together and making sure that we're having like FaceTime on video to work through all the problems. But I think after you do that for a while, it becomes second nature. It becomes the culture of the company. So it's actually like not that hard, but it definitely requires a different type of management. And I understand why people think it's weird.
Before I let you go, I have to ask, are there any good Western Australia stories, either like killer snakes, killer spiders, bugs of any kind, or just general wild Australian stories? Because there's always... It's almost like living on the moon or a different planet.
It is literally a different planet. It's so crazy. I can't describe it in a lot of ways. It's where I go when I like want to connect back to the earth in a lot of ways. One exciting story I can give you is that my parents still live there, and every few months there is a exciting visitor. The latest two were a visitor that was there with me when I lived there as a kid, which was a giant poisonous centipede.
How giant is giant?
Probably like 6 or 8 inches long.
That's a big
centipede. And like big and fat. Like, you're not just gonna like squish this thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And
It's meaty.
I mean, you're sort of like, I don't know what to do because it's so big, like bad things are going to happen. So one of those visited us when I was there living as a kid. So my mom was excited to tell me that there was another one appearing on my birthday as an omen. And they also sometimes get some snake visitors, which like to slither through the living room and surprise them.
Wait, slither through the living room?
Oh, yeah. And it's like, how do they get in? We don't know. How do they get out? We don't know. Sometimes they get lost and you can't find them again.
Oh, dude, my wife would be like, we're leaving this country immediately.
My husband can't hear these stories because I need him to go there in the future. So he can't listen to this.
And that poisonous centipede, that's not like, is that's like, oh, it's going to make you feel sick or it's like you're dead?
Probably somewhere in an unbearable in between,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Not worth risking.
Yeah. Wow, just random snakes slithering through the living room. That's I got to tell my wife that one. She'll love that.
Yeah, we don't get that in Detroit, and I'm
No. Well, look, thank you very much for your time. It's fascinating. I wish you luck convincing the world that your magic dust is magic.
It's magic. I'm so excited to share it with more people. Thanks for helping us do that.
Pleasure. And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Anna Pavlovich Hans of ION for her time. I want to thank you all for listening. I am on holiday this week, so you will not find my writings in the paper or at thetimes.co.uk, but check it out anyway. There's so much stuff there. I will be back next week with another fantabulous episode, and I'll be back on the writing coalface as well. In the meantime, take it easy. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.